So I'd like to get started. I think that we've got an action-packed afternoon for you with three excellent speakers for the clinical applications of stem cell research session. The one theme that unites them is they're all movers and shakers in their respective fields, and they're all very, very thoughtful about how they apply their research. So I'd like to spend the next 10 minutes talking a little bit about clinical applications of stem cell research. I'm Katrina Jameson. I'm the director of the Stem Cell Research Program over at the Moores UC San Diego Cancer Center, and very happy to be part of this vibrant stem cell community here in La Jolla. So we know in stem cell research there are a lot of challenges, but in particular when you try and apply the products of stem cell research to the clinic, they become even larger. We have both diagnostic and therapeutic challenges, and we know for applying all of the results of stem cell research that we have to be able to identify the right diseases to treat and be able to monitor those diseases in response to our therapies, which means that we have to devise novel sorts of clinical trials and implement new technologies to be able to assess the efficacy as well as the toxicity of these therapies. Now, what we've been grappling with in this field for a while in terms of clinical implementation of the results of stem cell research is how to take things forward therapeutically. Do we replace stem cells that have gone awry? Do we prevent degeneration? Or do we enhance regeneration? Those are all things that we'd like to discuss today in the context of this session. What is the best stem cell product? Or is it even a stem cell product that we should be applying clinically? Rather, should we be using targeted therapies to enhance regeneration or, again, to prevent degeneration in the first place? So this is what I call the W5 of clinical trials. Who, what, where, when, why? Why are we doing this? Who is the appropriate candidate for this? In what clinical setting should we consider this and when? So how can we eliminate cancer stem cells that may arise from either embryonic stem cell or induced pluripotent stem cell products? I think that's an important question to answer. And can we understand cancer better by understanding stem cell biology? So that's what I'll focus on for the next few minutes. We really need to shed light on these clinical applications. Now, the one sobering note is this paper that was published in PLOS Medicine. We're all very excited about the application of stem cell research, whether it derives from embryonic stem cell research or induced pluripotent stem cell research. That capacity to form a tumor is really what we want to avoid. Now, we know this happened in a child that had fetal stem cells injected into the brain for this disease called ataxia telangiectasia, where you make these dilated blood vessels in the eye, and they have a lot of neurological problems and also a predisposition to develop leukemia and other cancers. Now, what happened to this unfortunate child is that he developed a number of tumors, as you can see here, as a result of that unbridled stem cell proliferation. And clearly, these cells had not been differentiated adequately or at all. So it's just a cautionary note. We're very optimistic about stem cell therapy, but we have to be careful about how we apply it. Now, we know that stem cells can give rise to malignant stem cells. So in our lab, we've worked on cancer stem cells in collaboration with a number of people. They're kind of like finding a needle in a haystack. And I'm bringing this up because Wendy Levin will talk about a key collaboration that we've been involved in, partly funded by Pfizer, partly funded by CIRM. But it has allowed us to detect these cancer stem cells and really try to understand, as a result of sequential mutations and pathways that regulate differentiation, survival, self-renewing, and homing, how these cancer stem cells evolve. Now, we've done this generally in the context of what are called myeloproliferative neoplasms. So all that means is you make too many of one kind of cell in the bone marrow. As the bone marrow gets crowded out, patients start to make these cells outside of the bone marrow in other sites like the liver and spleen. That's called extramedullary hematopoiesis, and it can be quite painful. This is the knee of a patient of mine who had extramedullary hematopoiesis in her knee and was walking with a walker prior to the therapy that I'll talk to you about today. Now, what unites all of these disorders called myeloproliferative neoplasms is they derive from a stem cell. So we know that the initiating event for the myeloproliferative neoplasms that are triggered by a gene that has mutated called JAK2, and the other one, CML, which is triggered by a fusion gene called BCR-ABL, all of those initiating events appear to occur at the level of a hematopoietic stem cell. But the events that propagate the more malignant form of disease occur at a more committed progenitor level. So we're really trying to understand those events in the context of human stem cells. Now, what we did to understand the propagation of a disease called polycythemia vera, where you make too many red cells, is we take human patient-derived stem cells from patients that have polycythemia vera, and we transplant them into a mouse that has no immune system. Prior to transplantation of these stem cells, we tag them with lentiviral luciferase, so they glow if we give the mice luciferin. And what you can see here is if we treat the mice with vehicle over a two-week period, there's no change in that bioluminescent engraftment. But if we give them a selective JAK2 inhibitor, JAK2 is the mutant gene in these cells, then it decreases engraftment, and it decreases in particular the red blood cell engraftment in these mice. So that JAK2 gene is really fueling red blood cell production, and we can inhibit that with a selective JAK2 inhibitor made by a local company called Targagen, and it was the result of a collaboration that actually Ida Duchatte set up for us. She's our Director of Industry Relations. So we were very happy with this collaboration, even when we saw this. But what really blew us away was the capacity to decrease the JAK2 mutant allele burden. So this JAK2 mutation was going down in these mice. So this was work done by Ifat Giron and Anneli Abrams and Shire in the lab. So that was interesting and enough to get us to a clinical trial. We've finished this clinical trial. I should mention that because of this industry-academia collaboration that was partly funded by CIRM, we were able to go 1 year from lead compound identification to clinical trial, and it's been 1 year from opening the clinical trial to finishing it. So we've been able to abbreviate the timelines because of these incredible collaborations. We have people that are down the street in industry who are very talented. We have CIRM who's willing to take a chance and actually fund this stem cell research and be able to fund the cells or the inhibition of cells that actually initiate and propagate disease in these relatively rare disorders, but they provide a paradigm for designing better models of human disease because it's based on human disease. Now, if you look at what happened with the clinical trial, this was a multi-institutional clinical trial. What we saw was the preclinical model based on human polycythemia vera stem cells actually predicted the toxicity. So in the human polycythemia vera stem cells, we could see the main target of this JAK2 inhibitor was that capacity to form red cells. That was also the main toxicity in the trial. So we saw anemia, not pancytopenia, but anemia is the main toxicity in these 60 patients treated in the trial. The other thing that Gary Gilliland predicted from his model at Harvard, and we had some insight into as well, was that it would decrease extramedullary hematopoiesis, so spleen size. So 100% of the patients with this disorder called myelofibrosis that evolves most commonly from PV is that 100% had a reduction in spleen size, most of them at least a 50% reduction in spleen size. So the reason that matters is this is really painful. One of our patients thinks, you know, all his colleagues thought he was pregnant, and now that spleen has gone away. The other thing is, in the clinical trial, in the patients that had this mutant JAK2 gene, the mutant JAK2 went down significantly. So that means that if you build better preclinical models based on patient-derived stem cells, that sometimes you can predict both efficacy and toxicity in a clinical trial. So what we hope to do is take this into earlier stage patients with essential thrombocythemia and polycythemia vera, and it may also work in acute myeloid leukemia. So those are trials that we hope to get involved in. Now, what about disorders that always progress to acute leukemia? We've been working on this one disease called chronic myeloid leukemia for a while. 100% of patients that get this disease evolve to acute leukemia if untreated. So that makes them really different from the myeloproliferative neoplasms triggered by JAK2. Now, somebody mentioned that Shinya Yamanaka won the Lasker Award for his discovery of induced pluripotent stem cells. But at the same time, Brian Druker, Leiden, and Charles Sawyers got the Lasker Award for actually translating the discovery, for taking the BCR-ABL inhibitors from the bench to the bedside. That's often a graveyard of scientific endeavor. You don't get there. You don't get from the bench to the bedside, but they did it. And they put a lot of their optimism and ability into doing this. And it's something that's frequently unfunded, by traditional funding sources, and CIRM has helped to fill that gap. So the patients are very grateful to be able to do this more locally. Now, we know with CML that patients have a BCR-ABL gene, and that BCR-ABL drives the aberrant differentiation of hematopoietic stem cells. In a collaboration with Larry Goldstein and Jessica Russert, Angela Kort, and Kim Hyun Dao, what we did was we put human BCR-ABL into a lentiviral vector, and using an EF1 promoter, we were able to show high-level GFP expression in CD34-positive cells derived from human embryonic stem cells. This is a CIRM-funded grant. And basically what this showed is that BCR-ABL is necessary and sufficient to at least induce the chronic phase when it's expressed in these hematopoietic stem cells derived from embryonic stem cells. But it's not enough. So what this suggests is that at least chronic phase arises at the level of the primitive stem cell. But to get blast crisis, that acute leukemia form of this disease, other things need to happen. So we found a few years ago, looking at human blast crisis samples, that there was overexpression of this gene called beta-catenin. We know beta-catenin is an essential arbiter of hematopoietic stem cell self-renewal, and normally it's dampened down in its activation by the destruction complex, so APC, axin, and glycogen synthase kinase 3 beta. What we found in blast crisis CML samples was that the granulocyte macrophage progenitors had overexpressed beta-catenin in the nucleus, and that gave them the capacity to self-renew. So we asked, what population is able to self-renew in vivo? And it was the granulocyte macrophage progenitor population. This population was able to sustain blast crisis engraftment, not the blast, not the stem cells. So while the stem cells can initiate chronic phase, they cannot drive blast crisis. The reason is stem cells can turn off these self-renewal pathways. These GMP don't seem to know how to do that. So they're malignantly reprogrammed. When we collaborated with Irv Weissman to find out why this was, what we found was 57% of blast crisis samples had a missplice in glycogen synthase kinase 3 beta. And so that made it very difficult for GSK3 beta to inhibit beta-catenin. And the other thing that it seemed to do is activate a completely different pathway called Sonic Hedgehog. Now, Sonic Hedgehog has been the target of attempts at therapy with cyclopamine. Cyclopamine is derived from the corn lily, and what we know from Phil Beachy's work and other people's work is that the pregnant ewes that ate the corn lily had these calves with one eye, cyclopia. So that's why it was called cyclopamine. We know that cyclopamine inhibits smoothened, which is a main mediator of the Sonic Hedgehog pathway, and turns on GLIE to induce transcription. Now, thanks to a collaboration with Pfizer, and again, partly funded by CIRM, we were able to collaborate with Tanish DeRay and Phil Beachy on this paper, where they showed hedgehog signaling is essential for maintenance of cancer stem cells in myeloid leukemia. There was another paper published around the same time by Dirks and colleagues that showed that these leukemic stem cells that are BCR-ABL initiated are hedgehog-driven as well. Now, of course, we wondered, what about human stem cells? Because the other work was based primarily on mouse models of CML. So what Ani showed in the lab was that CML blast crisis leukemia stem cells have increased expression of GLIE1. It varies between patients, but it's always overexpressed. And that the Sonic Hedgehog inhibitor, in vitro at least, can dampen that expression. I think the most interesting thing, for me anyway, as somebody who sees patients in the clinic, was that she could show a decrease in secondary transplantation potential when she used a combination of a BCR-ABL inhibitor called dasatinib and the smoothened inhibitor, actually reduced the leukemia tumor formation potential completely. So this is the holy grail for trying to inhibit a cancer stem cell, is to get rid of that essential regenerative capacity of the cell. And at least in this model, it looks like the smoothened inhibitor is doing that. Now, we know that the molecular evolution of cancer stem cells is complex. CML gives us a better chance to look at those different mechanisms. We know aberrant differentiation occurs because of BCR-ABL. The patients can go into the blast crisis phase because of activation of beta-catenin and or Sonic Hedgehog. And what I didn't talk about today is they also have increased survival because of CD47 overexpression and BCL2 overexpression. But what that means is to target these cells that are fully potent cancer stem cells, where you're going to have a multi-pronged approach. And that's something that we're really delving into thanks to CIRM and our industry collaborators. I think there is a reason to celebrate. I think this is a truck we passed in the Bay Area when we were up there recently for a special symposium. But I think there's reason to celebrate because of the talent in this room. And I think we have a capacity to do things really differently for our patients. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the people that will be speaking that help our patients. Wendy Levin is the Associate Director of Translational Medicine at Pfizer Oncology. We actually work together in the clinic one day a week, which is a lot of fun. And that's our reality check. We're always reminded about what's important and that we have to limit toxicity, but also give people a chance by developing novel therapies. Dr. John Reed almost needs no introduction. He's the president and CEO of the Burnham. Was one of the most highly cited authors in the world for biomedical research and has made essential contributions to medicine. And then Patricia Churchland is a professor of philosophy and somebody that we will rely on completely, actually, as we go into these clinical trials that derive from the products of our stem cell research.